j'ai plumé la tête de mon alouette.
J'ai plumé la tête de mon alouette.
J'ai plumé la tête de la queue.
Hello and welcome to the Nerd Kitchen. This is Max Tavinci, and with me I have Ajit. Ajit, say hello.
Hello.
Today on our episode, we're going to talk about food from the region of Bengal. And this is again to break some of the stereotypes and that people have about food from the region. There's a lot of food that is not known about or it's underappreciated, underrated. And in popular literature or in as people go, there's only few things that people know of. Right? Everyone knows of the Rasagulla, people know of Mishti Doi and sweets like that, or they may know of like a Macha Jhol or something that you do with a Hilsa fish. But then there is a lot more, obviously. And this is why we thought we should have someone to speak about that and probably dispel some of these stereotypes and tell us more about what are the different delicacies that we have in Bengali food, their cultural significance, ingredients, and what the local environment has to the cuisine. And so therefore, we have someone who's kind of traveled a lot, and he often tweets a lot about food because he's really passionate about eating, at least. And so therefore, we have Bhalo Manush. You can follow him on Twitter at Bhalo Manush. So welcome to the pod, Bhalo Manush.
Hi, thank you for having me today, and good day to you, Max, and to you, Ajit.
Like I said, right now, Bengal is very peculiar because of the location within the Gangetic Delta, right? And it's veined with all these rivers, and therefore fish is one of the dominant choices for those who are at least non-vegetarian. And this same feature is shared with Bangladesh as well, because, you know, the Gangetic Plain kind of flows into there, and so that whole region now has a lot of similarities in food, which is kind of different to the other regions of the country. So that's why we wanted to see if we could come in and talk about some of these things. I know, like, one of the things at least I know of is the Bhapa method, right? I first found out about it when I had this Bhapa Doi, but then later realized that, Bhapa just means steam. And so there are a lot of other things that they do with it, you know, involves fish or vegetables as well. There are steamed and spices and kind of served. So why don't you start us off with something like that?
Yeah, so again, thank you. I think that's a really great question. And you sort of alluded to it, and I guess basically hit the nail on the head that it's kind of hard to actually define Bengal spatially because of the location. And you can take a sort of expansive view of Bengal as like the state of West Bengal plus Bangladesh. Bengali is like the seventh most spoken language. But as you said, not many people outside of the region know some of the peculiarities or some of the characteristics of the food. And even within Bengal, there are different characteristics based on which part of the region that you are from. So I am from a part of West Bengal near the border with Jharkhand and Orissa. And so the food that I have is sort of, it is in a gradient where a lot of the food that I grew up eating or that my parents and grandparents made were very similar to the food in Jharkhand and also in Mayurbhanj in that part of Orissa. My mother grew up near like the coastal area. So she had a lot of like sea fish and also very tamarind-based dishes. So that is like actually in some ways related to parts of southern India. But if you go more towards the east and people who came over to West Bengal after partition, then the food in the parts of Bangladesh are actually in many ways very, very different from the food. Bangladesh, obviously, that part is more riverine. And so they have more varieties of river fish than arguably we do. So there's a lot of variation there based on, and then obviously we haven't even touched on North Bengal and the cuisine there. That is a lot of, that has a lot of influences from Nepal and that region. So it's very hard to define spatially. And I think the perspective that I will take is like, you know, the blind men describing the elephant. So what I will do is put sort of my take on what I think is Bengali cuisine. So it's a very expansive topic to cover. You mentioned Bhapa, which exactly you're right, is steamed. So steamed is a form of cooking. Sometimes as you mentioned, like vegetables can be steamed, fish can be steamed. And what I've noticed, and I fervently believe, is that every great cuisine in the world has a variation of steamed dishes. So like in many states of southern India, there are these amazing steamed dishes that are, a lot of them are using some form of ground rice paste. And so those can be really good with either like coconut and jaggery. And we have some of those dishes like that. So we have both sweet and savory dishes. Now, obviously, if you go to Mexico and Latin America, they have tamales, which are fantastic, and savory steamed dishes. But also in China as well, like a lot of their breakfast dishes. So in many ways, I think this type of cooking is very underappreciated, but it also helps to lock in some of the flavors and some of the, I don't want to go too much into the nutritional aspects, but definitely steamed is a form of cooking that is very, very prevalent in Bengal.
It's kind of interesting that you mentioned China as you were describing this, because the other thing about food in Bengal is that it's also heavily influenced by other cultures as well. I understand there is some influence from the British, which is why you have these dark bangla kind of curries. And obviously, I think West Bengal is also home to like Chinese, in addition to the Indo-Chinese. I think I would really like to know more about, there is Indo-Chinese, and then there is this Chinese food that is specifically available in West Bengal. So it would be really nice to, you know, learn more about that as well.
That's a fascinating question, Ajit, and I was trying to figure out a way to push this into any question that you would have asked if had you not asked this. And okay. I think a lot of this has to do, and you're absolutely right, I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that for 150 years until the capital shifted to Delhi, as part of the colonial system of the British, Kolkata, or Calcutta as it was known then, was the most important, arguably the most important city in all of Asia. It was, it's hard to think of Calcutta right now as a very cosmopolitan city, but it was for a very long time. And so we have all of these, obviously all of these English and British influences in some of the cooking, so around the Park Street area. And so one thing that you'll see is that there's a lot of, even around Christmas, it's among even a non-Christian population, there's a culture of baking cakes and eating a lot of cakes. So some of these are very plum, like varieties of plum cakes and fruit cakes, but some are very, very good pastries as well. I mean, I've been to France and I've been to Paris, and some of the cakes there are absolutely spectacular. So that definitely comes from that culture of colonialism. The other thing is obviously after in about the one of the peculiarities is the Kolkata biryani. Everybody talks about it, and there's a lot of controversy about why there's a potato there and the egg. And a lot of it has to do with Nawab Wajid Ali Shah. And after he was deposed, he brought, he came over to Media Brews, which is part of Calcutta, and he brought his entire retinue there. And he loved Awadhi biryani, obviously. But there was a shortage of the meat, of ample amounts of meat for his retinue. And so a large potato was introduced at that time. So he moved in 1856, a year before the war of 1857. And so potatoes and eggs became a part of Kolkata biryani and has become a part of that ever since. He also brought over chicken chop. It was a white korma that was converted into a chicken chop. So that is another dish. You specifically asked about the Chinese, and that's also, there's a large Chinese population of merchants that came from the Hakka region. So obviously China is a large and diverse country. And so Hakka styles of cooking became very, very popular. And Indian Chinese cooking, as it is known, developed in that area. So obviously there's Chinese in the various regions of Chinese food, but Indian Chinese also developed and gave rise to a lot of things. And so that's why Indian Chinese has a lot of Hakka influences and Hakka noodles, as opposed to Peruvian Chinese or American Chinese.
and I was reading this somewhere, is that these Chinese immigrants from Hakka arrived in Tangra, right?
Yes.
And they came to Tangra because of all these tanneries that were around Tangra. And a lot of the Hindus didn't want to work in the tanneries, and therefore they had these Chinese immigrants come in. Yeah, of course, you know, now they've settled and kind of assimilated into the Indian culture, which is why, you know, like I said, this it gave the whole Indo-Chinese flavor or ways of cooking.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of that has to do with, like, when we talk about, this is true for every part of India, but a lot of, especially true of Bengal, where there was a lot of mixing. Bengal was at the crossroads. We also have to talk about the coastline of Bengal and its geographic location as the eastern part, where as a gateway, basically to the northeast of India, but also to Southeast Asia and to that region. But going back to to religion and caste and things like that. So a lot of the what is eaten also depends on the caste and the religion. Obviously, there's a large Muslim population, and what they eat is based on religious strictures, and what Hindus eat also depends a lot on caste and other strictures, and it's changed over time. So obviously dietary aspects have changed over time. But what I do also find fascinating, and to be honest, I had not actually realized this while I lived in Bengal in India, because you're eating the same food every day, is that I find that the cuisine of Bengal is very much somewhat different from the cuisine of other parts of India, in that there are a lot of these influences, especially like coconut milk and then the sour and sweet and savory, which in many ways, it's kind of, in a sense, it is a gradient. Like, I've been to Laotian restaurants and found that the sticky rice that they give is very, very much like a sticky rice that I might get in a village in Bengal. Or I could go to a Thai restaurant and find that the combination of the spicy and the sour and maybe even the coconut milk reminds me in a way that is more, in certain ways, is more resembles food that I would have at home than going to a dhawa or to a Punjabi style restaurant with butter chicken and things like that. So there is a lot of combination. And I have to mention that one of the most popular dishes in Bengal is this prawn or shrimp based dish called a malai curry. And it is basically, the word malai is very similar. It apparently comes from Malay, and it's basically because of traders, okay. Malaysian traders, they were using this coconut. So I had, last year I had a laksa in Singapore, and it was like, my God, this is exactly like a malai curry that my mom would make. And so there are all these connections between food that I think Bengal has with Southeast Asia that are not as appreciated, but also with South India and with Kerala as well. Like, we have one of the street foods that we have is called a Mughlai Parota, and it is basically, it's like a Kerala Paratha, and it's like the Paratha that you would get in Malaysia and in other places. But they have something called a Roti Talur, which is basically, it's a stretched out maida roti or something like that with an egg inside. And it was like these types of things, typically or normally you don't get that in other parts of India. So there are some of these connections that I find with cuisine, especially of Southeast Asia. So I'm glad you asked that.
So I just mentioned one specific aspect of food in Bengal. So before this show, actually a couple of days back, I was just reading because there are these specific condiments and spices that are used in cooking. One being panchfuran.
Yeah.
And the other being kasundi, which is the mustard paste. Now, interestingly, I was reading upon something else, and I realized that West Bengal actually doesn't figure as a major mustard producing state. So it actually, over the last 5 to 6 years, it's been consistently producing anywhere from 6 to 9% of the total mustard in India. So it's really fascinating to me how mustard is such an integral part of food in Bengal, in spite of it not being like one of the top producers of that particular grain or whatever. So that's really fascinating to me. Would you happen to shed some light on that aspect?
So that is a very interesting question. And you are absolutely right. Mustard is like, it forms like from mustard oil, which is basically, even in the United States where I currently live, like if we're going to make a fish-based dish, then we use mustard. It's not ubiquitous as sometimes Bengali cuisine also gets a bad rap that everything we use mustard or mustard oil. That is not true. But mustard is quite often used, and then a mustard-based sauce is also used to make like you said, a kasundi is more of a condiment, but that can also be used as a sauce to make a mustard-based based dish. Now, that is I will have to look more into like why or the actual the prevalence of mustard or how it came, but I do know that it is very much preferred because of the pungency that it adds to the dishes. And so and so the other misconception about Bengali food is that it's always spicy, which is not true. At least from the part of Bengal that I'm from, we actually use a little bit of sweet, like a sugar at the start to make the dishes a little bit more sweet as well. But as to your observation that Bengal is not a great producer of mustard, but imports it, it may be that in the past the flavors developed, and now because of population that, and I think that would be the case with hilsa as well. We don't have as much hilsa, so it has to be imported from Bangladesh. The flavors developed at a time when Bengal was unified, but now it's like there's not enough in West Bengal. So that is another. So I don't have a good answer to that, but it's a great observation.
That's okay, because I think you set up for the next question perfectly. But since you mentioned that there is some amount of sugar added to some of the preparations, I think we can't possibly have a podcast episode without really talking about the sweet tooth that Bengalis have. So I think we have to start getting into the desert. And obviously there are, I mean, I am personally a huge fan of Bengali sweets. For two particular reasons. A, it is not about the sugar. It is celebrating that fresh chenna.
Yes.
And the fresh chenna sandesh is something that is, I think, one of the best things to happen to desserts worldwide, period. It is singularly one of my most favorite sweets, and I really love it. And it's not about, just take something, add a boatload of sugar, and you have something sweet. It's really about like a subtle balance of what you want. So, a couple of questions to you, Bhalo Manush. It is, well, first of all, what really is Mishti Toi, according to you? And are there any regional variations in the method of preparation, etc.? And secondly, could you share your thoughts on how, I mean, is there anything specific within the culture, within West Bengal, that really, makes people appreciate sweets that much?
These are great questions. And again, I will go back to my answer for the first question and basically say that the entire Bengal region is very much a very large area and a gradient. So a lot of these sweets, so many sweets have been associated with regional areas, like basically small towns, both in East Bengal and in West Bengal. And some of these, even you can say, like there's a little bit of controversy as to where Rasgulla and some of these other things, Chhena Poda, originated because of parts of Odisha. So a lot of this, I think, had to do with, so one thing that is very underappreciated about Bengal is everybody talks about like Mache Jhol, but it is very much it was an agrarian society, and it was for a large part, it was a lot of poverty, and vegetarianism was actually quite common as well, at least among the Hindus. There's a very large strain of Vaishnavism and vegetarianism, but that is a vegetarianism that allows the, like Indian vegetarianism allows the consumption of milk products as well. So a lot of these were ways to get animal protein through those means. But definitely, I think these sweet shops have come up, and even in a small town, you'll find like sweet shops. So that's one of the most remarkable things is the Bengali sweet tooth is like in a small village, you will find a certain number of different types of shops and a sweet shop that makes these types of sweets fresh every day is found there as well. But there are also like different kinds of sweets. So those are the sweets that are made at shops. Sometimes they can be made at home, but there are also very, very large number of sweets that are associated with religious cultural festivals as well. And so some of these are steamed and these are very, very common. We call them like pites, and they're basically made around the time of Sankranti and times like that. So there's a very large culture of making, and some of those actually do contain milk and products like that as well. So we have the products that are made from the shops. Then we have this second variety that is either made at Sankranti time for Hindus, but also like during Eid and as well. There's all these kinds of vermicelli pies and things like that. So simayar pies. I think that is basically an integral part of like how of what people eat. The other question you asked about mishti doi. So I think it is a very popular export right now. I don't know if there's much more that can be said about that. I personally enjoy it, but I to be honest, I basically prefer the sour version of yogurt.
Ah, okay.
And just to make sure that we're not going to prison or anything, there is a Bengali Rasagulla, which is, you know, has the GI tag for Bengal, but apparently there are other Rasagullas as well. So that I just want to make sure the state of Odisha doesn't pick up Ajit and arrest him. Just laying that out there. It's just the Bengali Rasagulla that Bengal has, rights and a GI tag to, but there are other regions and other states that also make their own variations of the Rasagulla and who should not be pissed off by this. So on that, right, one of the things I found very interesting about Bengali cuisine is that the traditional meal is served over courses, which is not something very common to most of the country. What is even more surprising to me for that in that is that the first course is a bitter course called the shukto. Why is this like this? Do you have any idea about that? Like, why would you start a meal with a bitter course first? Is it because of a palate cleanser, or is it some medicinal values? What's that going on here?
Yes, you're absolutely right. And depending on who you ask, the Bengalis obviously love their food, and it's like served over many, many courses. And I think some people were saying during the lockdown that the men folk who are not contributing their fair share in the kitchen are still expecting the 5 or 6 courses that they used to get in normal times. But yeah, so you're right. The first is a bitter. It doesn't necessarily have to be a shukto. Sometimes it can be like something made of a bitter melon or karela. It can be like either a small kind of a vegetable dish, or even fried. Some people even like the bitters of the neem leaf to have that. I absolutely love shukto. It's you know what it is, but it's basically a melange of different vegetables. It has drumstick, it has plantains, and it has that little bit of sour, or so that bitterness from bitter melons, or yeah, from Karela as well. But it's definitely, I think the general thought is it's a palate cleanser. And then, and the thing is, there's a very particular order. So if you go to a house, there's a very particular order in which you're supposed to eat the food. If you break that order, then your host will look at you disapprovingly.
Yeah, and that's why we picked up on that. Like, for example, in a traditional South Indian wedding, also, you know, food served in courses, and that like there is an order, right? You first serve this, and then you go this, and then the dal comes, then the rasam, the sambar, you know, there is an order in which you're supposed to eat, and they kind of serve it in that order as well. So that part, the multiple course part, I was kind of familiar with, but what threw me off was that you start in the course with, you know, a bitter,
It definitely a palate cleanser. And I think if we're talking about like weddings, then like it'll give you like back in the day, it used to be like a leaf plate. Like if there were a lot of people, it would start with a salt and then a small piece of lime and then onions and pepper, a little bit of something fried, rice. I don't think the weddings always had a bitter. This was more for home cooking. And then after that, there would be some kind of a dal and then a vegetable curry. After that, a fish dish. And if there was it was very rich. It's a kalia. It's a very rich fish dish. And then after that, the meat. Usually the other strategy was they try to fill you up before they get served the more expensive or high value protein dishes. So they try to fill you up with the greasy and the fatty and the other stuff. And then towards the end, obviously there is the sweets. So usually two types of sweets, rasagolla, sometimes a chutney, and then a papad, and then that would be done. And also, mishti doi. So yeah, that was usually a standard wedding course. And those were the types of dishes expected. But I guess, now things have changed and now it is more of a buffet style.
So one of the things that I've noticed, and again, this could just be because of me and what I've heard from my friends, is that Bengalis love their fried foods. At least, again, this is going back to I have a very small sample set to make this, which is why I wanted to ask you about it, is that how much truth to that is? Because I've heard a lot of these dishes where, you know, begun bhaja or alu bhaja, potol bhaja, and not only just vegetables, but even like the eggs of fish eggs of like the rui fish are also kind of deep fried. So can you shed more light about this love for deep frying?
But I mean, this is absolutely like you said, begun bhaja, which is the brinjal fry, or alu bhaja. These are served with rice, but even outside of that, like people when they eat, so street food, a lot of street food is fried food. So it's like what we call a fish fry, which is basically, I don't want to say it's like a fish and chips, but it's like a fish cutlet. And then there are the cutlets, there's things called chops, which are basically small rounded balls covered in besan with potato inside, so it's like a croquet. Those are fried and eaten. So a lot of fried food is consumed, and so there's a standing joke about Bengalis eating a lot of fried food and getting hyperacidity, and then popping in a couple of jelly cells. So this is year round. There are even things called it's called a fuluri, which is basically. What it is you take a very large vat of hot oil and you drop in besan. So it's nothing else. It's just round drops of besan, and you take it out and you eat it. So all kinds of pakoras, definitely. But yeah, it's extremely common, and I think widely loved to eat fried foods.
Yeah, because the things that stood out to me, again, I've heard of people frying potatoes or vegetables and for example, especially pakoras and street food. But things that stood out to me especially were that the fish eggs being fried and pop. I don't know what it's called now, but it's like a poppy seed.
Yes. Posto vada, which is basically, it's a paste of the poppy seeds and made into absolutely delicious. And then these other types of vadas and things like that. It's sometimes made with dal. So variations on, I would say, even the falafel, very, very common. So fried food like that. But yeah, even the fish egg is mixed in with a batter and fried. It's quite delicious, I have to say.
And speaking about fishes, so the hilsa I know, the ruhi I know, and I've also heard of the katla fish. Are there any other fishes?
Yeah, so there are quite a lot of fish, and I think the number and variation with the population increase in West Bengal, I think the number and variation of fish is sadly declining, and the price of fish is increasing over time as well. So a lot of the fish that that even I saw growing up, the prices now are like absolutely astronomical. And I think if you talk to anyone and you raise this topic, they will have some issues about this as well. But even in Bangladesh, like because they're more, they have a lot of rivers, the number of fish there, starting from Topshe, Pabda, all these kinds of freshwater fish. So the thing is that most of the fish that are eaten, so I asked a friend of mine, I mean, he was from the UK. And so he was like, well, we love our fish and chips, and most of our fish is basically seafood. It's from the ocean. Well, in Bengal, partly because of the result of being, of having so many rivers, it's mostly sweetwater fish. And so those are the most coveted fish are that. Obviously, hilsa has a different life cycle. And so you get it at different parts. But oceanic fish, apart from, I would say, like pomfret now is very highly coveted. It wasn't so much before, but pomfret is very easy to eat, very nice fish. But it was, but apart from that, most of the fish are from the river region. Definitely a lot of varieties of fish. Right. As far as prawns, yeah, they're freshwater prawns, and some of them, so this was, some of them are absolutely massive, and the very, very large prawns can be about the size of like actual lobsters. They can be very, very
big. Oh, wow.
They're and extremely expensive. So they're very, 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 very expensive, and usually reserved for honored guests. As for the fish, yeah, you mentioned various kinds of puna fish like rohu, katla, and each has their different qualities and flavors. But the fish head was also traditionally reserved for an honored guest. So sometimes like the son-in-law would get a very large fish head with a little bit of the fish, obviously, near the gill attached. And so I think the art of being able to eat a fish head, a whole fish head, is now is dying. I don't know how many people know how to do that, but that was also something reserved for an honored guest.
I just wanted to mention a couple of things and also learn from you. One of the things that I really like about Bengalis is that they're really passionate about food. I mean, people talk about food, sure, but I think Bengalis, and I think a lot of these festivals, okay, so, I mean, would love to hear more about you from on the foods that are associated with specific festivals, Durga Puja, Kali Puja, the whole Pati Sapta. And I think every time this season comes around, when people talk about festivals, it's like, yeah, sure, we are planning for the festival, but the focal point of conversation is more often than not food. So just tell us more about this whole love for food and any festival specific food that you can share.
Yeah, this is a great question, and obviously food always ties us to memory and to place, and makes us nostalgic about, at least for someone like myself in middle age, makes me a little bit nostalgic about all the places that I grew up, all the people that I was with, and all the things that I had. But it is definitely an integral and one of the most vital parts of Bengali culture, I would say. A lot of it had to do with it. In general, Bengali food was, for centuries, it was a peasant food. There were a number of famines that happened, and so every part of the fish, every part of the vegetable was eaten. And very, very intricate recipes developed from this. And so I think what happened was, like, people would eat very long, elaborate lunches. And then after a while, they would think, as soon as lunch was over, what can we eat for dinner? And they still do that. And I even remember growing up, like if I was invited to someone's house, when I came back, the first thing that my mother or my aunt or someone would ask is like, "Ki khete diye chilo? What did they feed you?" So that is like, basically, that was such a huge part of the culture. And I think we were always perpetually hungry as well, like always ready to eat and to try different things. But there are, as you mentioned, there are different foods associated with different days and with different festivals. Like I said, for Christmas, a lot of people eat cakes and various types of pastries around that time of year. The weather is very nice, so some people go on picnics and they eat at restaurants. Durga Puja, those 4 days, people eat different things. A lot of people eat out. So I think that a lot of people eat a lot of restaurant food during that time as well, but also a very, very rich and spicy food at that time as well. Yeah. Saraswati Puja, everybody thinks about like, so with the pujas, there are also these prasads. And so there's definitely various types of fruits that are available at that time. And then a special khichdi, which is made for offering, which is also given and eaten at that. Kali Puja is associated in many places with the ceremonial sacrifice of animals, and so some of those animals are eaten as well. Although I must say that one of the misconceptions is that Bengalis forever have always been eating a lot of meat and a lot of rich dishes. I think this is more a modern occurrence, and I mean, fish was always a staple part of the diet, one piece of fish or something like that. But nobody was eating biryani or chicken chop every day. And even if I come from fairly orthodox, my grandparents were fairly orthodox. And so they would not eat meat except for, like, I'm talking about one of my grandfathers. He lived in a village. He would not eat meat except, and it was never ate chicken, because chicken was taboo. Would only eat goat or what is called mutton one day a year. And that was like, it was during a puja. He would dip into a pond, he would eat it, and then he would dip into a pond again. He was never eaten inside the home. And so there were all these things, and they were fairly orthodox about that. They never ate chicken eggs. I never actually figured out why. The duck eggs were allowed, but chicken and chicken eggs were considered taboo. So a lot of these things have changed over time, and definitely there's a religious aspect to it as well. Eid and Urs, I would definitely associate with different kinds of barfis and halwas and things like that. Those kinds of foods have obviously come from Western Asia and those places, but there would be mounds and stacks of those that you could go and buy from these festival places as well. So yeah, I think food is a very, very important part of that culture.
And one thing also that has to be pointed out is that if we look at the street food scene, I think different places have their own version of chaat. I mean, Delhi, Lucknow, they are talked about quite a bit. Banaras is talked about quite a bit. Bombay, of course, is talked about quite a bit. But I think West Bengal also has its, jewels, like the Puchka and the Dal Muri and the Ghugni. So it would be really nice if, you know, because I don't think these are as popular as some of the other areas that I mentioned. So if you could just illuminate our listeners, you know, on the whole Bengali chaat scene, that would be really nice.
Yeah, okay, so Puchka is like, it is amazing. And I can talk about Kolkata Puchka, but Puchka is also quite popular in Dhaka. And so I need to go at some point and try it out there as well. But it's basically, it's inexpensive, and you can go stand there with your friends and just like you keep eating them one after another. It's like basically taking like tequila shots of this very sour tamarind juice and people have these cravings for them. So it's basically a lot of college students and university students after their classes will go and say, let's go have some puchkas. And so they'll have that. Then there are all these other kinds of fried food as well. Fried food is ubiquitous. So a vegetable chop and cutlets and things like that. And then the egg roll and the chicken roll and the chicken double egg roll is a variations of having the this paratha with the egg inside and this kebab. And so there is controversy about whether you added a salad to it and sauce to it. And there are purists like myself who said, no, you shouldn't add any salad. Just basically have it plain with the flavor. So those are different things. Ghugni is very, very common. It's a cheap, inexpensive food. It's made usually from peas, but it all can be also made from chickpeas as well. And I this is one of the dishes that I can make myself at home. And whenever I crave, it's highly nutritious. It has a lot of protein and it's portable. Same can be said of jhal mudi as well. So jhal mudi contains mudi, which is a staple, which is this puffed rice. But jhal mudi is a mixture of oil and then chana chur and onions and cucumbers and all these other things. And it's the other thing is it's like a snack food, but it's also portable. So jhal mudi is something that people would eat like if they're on a train or going somewhere. So I think like street food wise, Kolkata has a lot to offer. I think a lot of people even subsist on street food because it's so generally high quality and very inexpensive. So you can, a lot of people will leave home they'll eat the, because often offices start late, but even the ones that don't, they'll eat a rice meal at home, then they'll go out and then in the afternoon, they'll eat some street food and then come back home and then have a, dinner is usually lighter. Dinner is not typically as heavy as lunch, but the rice is like, yeah, we have to talk about rice. I mean, rice is, I personally yes. I love rice, but rice is a staple. Everybody that I know, you will find people who don't like sweets, who don't like rasagulla. You will find people who don't like fish, but I don't think you'll find a Bengali who doesn't like rice.
So just going back to that jhal mudi that you mentioned, I think there's two things that I found kind of interesting. I mean, first of all, I've lived in Haldia for about a year. So I did my 9th standard there, and I've been to Calcutta a few times. So I think the addition of mustard oil is what really takes that jhal mudi to the next level, because that whole combination is ridiculously good. And the other thing, I don't know if it's authentic or not, but some of these street vendors, they also sell a jhal mudi masala, which I find fascinating because I never see like a bhelpuri masala or anything of that sort being sold anywhere else. So this whole spice mix that goes into jhal mudi and that being sold as a standalone item is something I find quite fascinating.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that, but I think it's fairly easy to, and I've experimented with recreating that. But I think you're right about the mustard oil. I mean, that's definitely adds to the punch. And the chili pepper, yeah. The diced green chili. I think you have
absolutely
that in there.
But I personally, I'm a huge fan of the sharp flavors that each condiment brings in, like a kasundi and the punch koran, the use of radhuni, which right. is again something fairly unique to West Bengal and that region. So all these somehow meld together and create a very, very flavorful preparation. And whether you add it to meat or vegetables, I think there are certain flavors that are really unique to this region. And I personally am a massive fan of Bengali food. Of course, but I'm a vegetarian, but I can take eggs. So the variety to sample is limited. But I think whatever I've had, it's been ridiculously good.
And I should state that as well, is that everybody talks about Bengali non-vegetarian food or fish and meat and these types of dishes. But I do think that Bengali, given, I mean, Bengali vegetarian food, I think is is absolutely amazing. And in many ways, I think it's, this is going to be controversial, but I do think it's superior to our non-vegetarian food. I mean, things like the raw jackfruit, which are used, the raw papaya, our bitters, various kinds of greens, I mean, above and beyond like your standard spinach and things like that. And the use of the every part of the banana tree. The banana tree obviously has a major significance, but the banana blossom is actually my most favorite vegetable in the entire world. And I know it takes a lot of a lot of
cleaning
and processing
to get,
it's very labor intensive to get it out of there, but that's my absolute most favorite vegetable in the world. But we also eat like the edible stem of the banana. So, and a lot of that is, I think, as I mentioned, is that it is a very peasant cuisine that has developed over a very long period of time in a very fertile part of the country. And for the most part, even though a lot of people were non-vegetarian and are not vegetarian, they could not afford, or it's not even part of our diet to eat that much meat, especially. So the vegetable dishes developed over time. And there were also these caste restrictions as well. I mean, widows could not eat any kind of, even like garlic and things like that. So,
Okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was very, very over time. I mean, in the past, I don't know how much of this is adhered to. And obviously that's a personal choice. And there's a whole lot of complexity around whether that was fair or not. And it wasn't. But I mean, there were economic reasons that they were imposed. But a sort of side effect of that is that there are these very, very humble yet delicious cuisines or aspects of the cuisine that developed from people who did not have enough to eat and were exploited. And we've seen this in other parts of the world as well. I mean, with in the Americas, with the people who came over as slaves, they didn't have a lot to eat, and they didn't have all the best, they didn't have best cuts of meat or the best vegetables, but they created a very vibrant cuisine out of poverty. And I think a lot of that happened in Bengal as well.
I can safely say that we barely kind of scratched the surface, because we haven't really delved deep into the regional nuances. Because if we talk about regions like Darjeeling, which is kind of known for some of the best tea on earth, you know, what kind of food would be there? Because it's not really kind of seafood, because it's more about the hills. So that it's been really, really wonderful having you. And I'm sure our listeners would really, you know, open their hearts to this wonderful region of India, known for not only its variety of food in terms of meat, fish and the greens, but also people who are really, really passionate about talking about their food. So it has been really, really wonderful having you. All this stuff has gotten me hungry. And thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and all the little nuggets of information.
Thank you so much and for having me. And it was a pleasure talking to you today.
So that was our episode on Bengali food with Bhalo Manoj. Thank you again, Bhalo Manoj, on behalf of Ajit and myself. It was an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast today. As always, please check out the Nerd Kitchen Pod on Twitter. We're also on Facebook. And do let us know what other episodes you would like us to talk about. As always, keep listening and stay safe. Arrête, 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 arrête.